Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and we are about to have a conversation with Derek Jensen, whose work we read in Orion all the time. He's an environmental author, an activist, one of the leading thinkers on issues of sustainability and the philosophy and political action of environmentalism. As I said, he's a regular columnist for Orion. His books include Endgame and Truths Among Us. Derek Jensen, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So we really have, we talked about this last article you wrote for Orion magazine, and then actually my producer, Cricket Aronson, brought your name up and said, okay, well, let's get him on here at last and talk to him. So here you are.
Great.
One of the things that just started out of the box here, I mean, in the last piece you wrote, and we were talking about that we were kind of pondering what people had said about nuclear power, especially the meltdown that took place in Japan and what should have happened. One of the things you posit is that and a very radical notion, I think, for most people to listen to, which is, I don't care what power you use, the problem is that development has made electricity too commonplace in our existence, and we can never survive the amount of energy that we need. Is that basically what you're saying?
Well, what I'm saying is that we should acknowledge that the industrial generation of electricity isn't sustainable. And, it makes nice conveniences. It's, you know, nice to have refrigeration, and it's nice to have a space heater so my toes can stay nice and toasty, but you have to look at the whole. There is no way that any industrial generation of electricity is sustainable. Just name some form of generating electricity, and I'll tell you why it's not sustainable.
Like, what about what we're doing right now? The telephone.
Well, the telephone does require electricity, and it requires wires. And where do you get the metal for the wires? You need mining. And for electricity, you know, obviously oil is not sustainable. There's a finite amount on the planet, and burning it is causing a tremendous number of problems. So great, let's try solar photovoltaics. Well, unfortunately, solar photovoltaics require the mining of rare earths, which are creating these toxic seas in China. And I just learned last week also that there are some rare earth mining places in Africa where the conditions are even worse than in coal mines, where people are basically in very, very small areas, you know, basically the size of a coffin, you know, chipping away. It requires all of that in order to – it requires the infrastructure in order to maintain those. It's we like to think it's magic that if you flick on a light that – the light goes on, and that's just it. But that electricity came from somewhere. It came from dams, and dams kill rivers. They kill salmon. They kill sturgeon. They kill all the communities around the rivers. They inundate. There were some dams in China recently that required, oh, gosh, I don't remember. It was like more than 1 million people had to leave their villages. And right now they're thinking of putting in, I believe, 6 or 13 dams on the Mekong. And that would inundate, oh, gosh, like 1.5 million people. And it's all for a generation of electricity. So what happens is that we're really good at not thinking about the externalizations, the externalities associated with all of these luxuries we have.
So but what one of your – the sense I get from reading – your book and reading all the columns you've written for Orion, mm-hmm. is that part of humankind's problem began with the Industrial Revolution. You can even take it back to the beginnings of agriculture in some ways. That when we started forming into more cohesive, settled units, it began to change the nature of existence on this planet.
Well, I wouldn't say it's so much settling into cohesive units, because I live in Northern California, and the land where I live is actually Talua Indian land. And the Talua lived here for at least 12,500 years, if you believe what science tells you. And if you believe that the Talua tell you, then they lived just in the beginning of time. But in either case, they lived here for at least 12,000 years. And they didn't trash the place. And they were settled here. They stayed here. They would move a little bit. They would go up in the inland in the summer, and they would come back down, you know, maybe 50 miles up in the summer, and then come back down during the winter months. But they lived here for a long time, and when the first Europeans arrived here in the 1830s and 1840s, the place was a paradise. There were just, the stories are extraordinary, of so many salmon that they would keep you awake all night because they're so loud slapping their tails against the water. And fish were, horses were afraid to get in the water because there's so many fish. And you could, people sometimes were afraid to put their boats in water for fear they would capsize. And we've heard similar stories all across the country, you know, on the East Coast of passenger pigeons in flocks so large they darken the sky for days at a time, or whales were actually a hazard to shipping. There were so many whales. And I read this one account off of New England that there were so many whales, it looked like it was foggy because of the spraying. And there were fish shoals so thick off New England that it would actually slow down the ships when they would try to go through it. And one of the things that this culture does, and not every culture, but this culture does, is it consumes land bases to make war machines, for one thing, but it converts land bases into material goods, into power, and then it destroys that land base, and then it moves on to the next one. And I'll just say this really, really quickly, that when people think about Iraq, is the first thing that they think of normally cedar forests so thick that sunlight never touches the ground? That's how this culture was, and that's how Iraq was before the beginnings of this culture. The first written myth of this culture is Gilgamesh deforesting the plains and hillsides of Iraq. And so what they did is they would cut down the forests to make cities, and then, of course, that would help destroy that land base. So they would have to then conquer another land base, and they moved into the Near East, and then they moved, you know, through Greece. And this is how the whole Greece was heavily forested. Who are they? The Aristotle and Aristotle, Socrates, and Plato all complained that deforestation was harming water quality. And, you know, it continued. The forests of North Africa fell to build the Roman and the Egyptian and Phoenician navies. And so this is a long, long pattern, and it's continuing to this day as this culture systematically destroys the land bases in order to maintain a very powerful way of living. And by power, what I mean is the definition I like of power is, or in this case, the definition I like of a machine is something that converts raw materials into power. And that's what all of our machines do. And it's converting the entire planet. And that, you know, may or may not be okay on an infinite planet, but on a finite planet, obviously it's not a plan with a future.
Well, if finite in terms of what the Earth can sustain, because there's only a finite a number of forests and space that you can use on this planet before you use it all up. But the question then is, so what do you do? I mean, part of your thesis is that capitalist exploitation on the planet is destroying this planet and the people on it and the non-human living beings on the planet as well. So then what? I mean, you know, if we come to a place now where we have public transportation, if you have trains, it means electricity or some kind of batteries. Which means rare earth minerals, which means whatever it means to fuel those things. If you have your iPads and your laptops, it's all these rare earth minerals. One of the reasons I think we'll never leave Afghanistan is because we're in competition with Chinese capitalists over those minerals, and we don't want to let them go. So everything we use in today's world, this radio studio I'm sitting in, I don't know where you are at this moment, but the world you're sitting in some ways, are all made possible because of the madness and pollution of Industrial Revolution. So then what does humankind do?
Well, you've succinctly stated the problem. And, you know, thank you very much. Thank you for the interview. Goodbye. You know,
it's good talking to you, too. No,
that's exactly it. And it's like a doctor friend of mine says, that the first step toward cure is proper diagnosis. And so what we need to do is to acknowledge that we are in overshoot, that we've overshoot carrying capacity, and to acknowledge that everything you just said, to acknowledge that even high-speed rail requires non-sustainable, requires empire. I mean, there are so many people who want to stop U.S. empire, and that's great. We all, I mean, anybody who has a good heart wants to stop United States imperialism. But so many people don't understand that this way of life would not be possible without imperialism. They want to stop empire without stopping the fruits of empire. And so I think the first step is to recognize where we're at, and the next step is to recognize exactly how bad the situation is. I mean, 200 species went extinct today, and 200 species will go extinct tomorrow, and the day after, and the day after. And to recognize that they're my brothers and sisters. They're all of our brothers and sisters. And to recognize that global warming is really scary, and it is already causing tremendous harm. It's like, okay, so now that we've recognized that, what could we do? It's like, and part of me, you know, this is maybe going in a direction that's too much for just a short interview, but one of the things that is pretty central to a lot of my work, I don't see a lot of people talking about, is that the dominant culture, I think, really is crazy. I mean, it's a lot of the stuff we see is not rational at all. There are the commercial fishing fleets all around the world are subsidized by governments to a degree for more money than the actual value of the catch. So we would all actually be better off if all these commercial fishing fleets, if everybody was just paid, you know, the same amount of money to stay home and sit around in their underpants and watch The Price is Right, you know, we'd all be better off. And it's the same with, like, not many people, especially in the East, know about this, in the Eastern United States, that the national forests in the United States put out these timber sales that lose money. They're actually subsidizing the timber industry by selling old-growth trees for the price of a cheeseburger, literally, and by doing all sorts of accounting shenanigans where they will amortize the cost of a road over 1,000 years. It's just crazy stuff. And so let's pretend for a second that we were actually reasonable people and that decision-making was actually reasonable. A lot of good things could be done pretty quickly by changing subsidies. You know, they could even keep capitalism for a little while, which I'm opposed to capitalism, but they could keep capitalism for a little while just by paying. It's like years and years ago. You remember George McGovern, long time ago?
Yes.
He once had a conversation with the head of, I don't remember which company it was. It might have been Rockwell. It was one of the one of the military contractors. And he was saying, this is about the B-1 bomber. And he said to him, so, you know, if we gave you the same money to build school buses instead of building B-1 bombers, would you do it? And the guy said, of course, all we care about is making money.
Right.
And then both McGovern and the military contractor, both just started laughing because they knew that you could never get that through Congress. And my point is that it's crazy that, so if we were living in a sane culture, there could be lots of money put toward reforestation, put toward reclaiming the prairies, put toward helping battered women, for that matter. You know, lots of money could be spent on useful things instead of being spent on, you know, it's the old bumper sticker. You know, it'll be a great day when the military has to hold a bake sale and schools have all the money they want.
Right.
But, okay, given that that's not true, and given that the culture is essentially sociopathological, that's another piece to add to this puzzle, is why are the priorities so incredibly wrong?
And we are sociopathological because, from your perspective, because we blindly stay addicted to all these things that we love and we need or think we need.
Well,
is that what you mean?
I think part of it, what I'm really getting at is, I think that the power system itself is sociopathological. I mean, corporations, I'm not the first to say that corporations are really the reification, the legal version of a sociopath, because what they're supposed to do is accumulate power. And corporations are limited liability. I mean, by definition, a limited liability corporation, what that says is that it's not, there is no liability held to the people involved. I mean, a joke that I've told for years, which is not very funny, two riddles, is what do you get when you cross a long drug habit, a quick temper, and a gun? And the answer is two life terms for murder, earliest release date 2026. What do you get when you cross two nation states, a large corporation, 40 tons of poison, and 8,000 dead human beings? And the answer is retirement with full pay and benefits. As Warren Anderson, CEO of Union Carbide, you know, why is it that if, I mean, like the I never can say the name of the cult in Tokyo, the Amrin Shri?
Yes, right.
You know, they were planning on putting cyanide into the subways of Tokyo. And, you know, what do you call somebody who plans on poisoning people in subways in Tokyo? You call them a terrorist. You put them in prison. What do you call somebody who plans on, who conspires to poison the groundwaters of the United States? You call them Dick Cheney, you know? That's, you call them frackers. You call them oil and gas men. And one of the problems is that the entire legal system is set up to protect atrocities caused by those in power. And we end up with essentially enforcement-free zones in terms of atrocities by those in power. Why did the owners of Massey Coal not have to have any accountability for the miners who died, much less murdering mountains in West Virginia? And why did Tony Hayward, you know, what did he get for killing human beings and for murdering much of the Gulf of Mexico? What he got was, I believe, a severance package of $1 million a year. And that's one of the things I mean by this culture being, by the system being sociopathological, is that it's set up to reward this extreme antisocial behavior. And it's like years ago, a cop wrote to me, and he said, you know, cops aren't the problem, he said. Our job is to protect people from sociopaths. And I wrote back and I said, you know, that's great, but how come you only protect us from poor sociopaths? Why don't you protect us from rich ones? And he didn't write me back. I mean, that's a huge and important question, is this whole system is set up to protect those who, in power. You know, what would happen if you were giving people orders to torture people, you know, and you got caught and you admitted it in public? You know, presumably you'd get arrested. What happened when Dick Cheney and George Bush did that? They do it for reasons of power, and that ends up being acceptable. That's what I mean by sociopathological. And then we can talk about individuals. But part of the problem, too, is that positions of power attract people who are interested in power. And so people who are of good heart are not very often going to end up in positions of power. This is a fundamental flaw in the whole system. It's like, you know, I remember when I was in elementary and junior high school, we heard all the time about how the United States government is so great because there's all these checks and balances. But what they never said, what I had to figure out, you know, later on by reading Radicals is, wait a second, these checks and balances are only among three different branches of rich people. There aren't checks and balances. Where are the checks and balances between the poor and the rich? The poor don't have power to keep the rich in check. And that's, I mean, another joke I tell sometimes is that, you know, I fully believe that we need fundamental, systematic change at the deepest level. But I can jokingly suggest that I have a technological solution that would, and legislative solution that would solve everything, which is, it's a very simple piece of technology called, it's a remote-controlled cigar cutter. And what I would use this for would be, so if somebody wants to put something in the Gulf of Mexico, or if somebody wants to, you know, bundle a bunch of mortgages, or they want to do something that could harm other humans or non-humans, then you say, okay, great, you promise this isn't going to be harmful. Well, what we need to do then is we need to put a remote-controlled cigar cutter around your genitals. And, you know, if the Gulf spills, I mean, if the oil well spills in the Gulf, you know, put the consequences back on them.
So, Derek, by the way, the lines are open, 410-319-8888. I meant to say that. This is live tonight, and we're talking with Derek Jensen. Feel free to jump in at 410-319-8888.
So, yeah, good grief. I don't know what comments we're going to get about that one. But the point is that there is no accountability for those in power.
So, all right. But there are a couple of things that I think that you say in your writings. One is that we can't do this through kind of a feel-good environmental conferences. I remember the piece you wrote about that, that this calls for much more serious action. And you're not talking about violent action, but you're talking about something has to be done to change the course of the system. We just can't do it by, as you put it in one piece you wrote, by taking shorter showers or just buying hybrid cars.
Well, that has to do with in the 1980s was the first time the corporate press called human beings citizens more often than human beings. I'm sorry. Called human beings consumers more often than human beings. And that's a huge transition, because if those in power can convince us that, and it's not a conspiracy. It's like a friend of mine says, you don't have to have a conspiracy when everybody thinks the same. But the point is, if we can be convinced through whatever means that we're actually consumers and not human beings, then our means of resistance are much less. Basically, as a consumer, you can either buy or not buy. As opposed to if you're a citizen, You can buy, not buy, vote, not vote, have boycotts, or, as it says in the Declaration of Independence, when a government becomes destructive of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, it's the right of the people to alter or abolish it. You can't do that as a consumer. And as a human being, more than a citizen even, you remember that you have teeth and you have claws, and you have a community, and you need that community, or you're going to die. And so we should not allow ourselves to be put into the consumer box. But B, the consumer box is really a misdirection anyway, because 90% of the water used by human beings, we all hear all the time the world's running out of water. Well, that's not true. The world's not running out of water. The world has as much water as ever. But the problem is that more than 90% of water is used by agriculture and industry. They tell us we should take shorter showers, but all that's going to do is ruin your social life. Because the truth is, we're not using very much of the shower. Municipal human beings use the same amount of water as municipal golf courses. So getting rid of golf courses would solve much more than simply taking a shorter shower. And it's the same with waste production. If I reduce my waste down to nothing, I wear tennis shoes till I fall off my feet, and I don't buy anything with packaging, blah, 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 great. I think the average per capita waste production in the United States is about, I don't remember, a couple tons, 2,000 pounds, 4,000 pounds, something, I don't remember. And that's great. You've reduced it. Wonderful. But I got bad news, which is the annual waste production in the United States per capita is actually about 26 tons. And all the rest of it, basically 24, 25 tons, I think it's 97% of it, is produced, once again, by agriculture and industry. So when they tell you that you should reduce, that's just a very, very small piece of the pie. I mean, the U.S. military is the largest single user of oil in the planet. And so there are much larger levers than simply personal consumption. And the more important thing is that when they get you to focus on, oh, I'm the problem, it takes the attention off of them and puts it onto you. But I'm not the problem and you're not the problem. The problem is the entire system and the large corporations.
So the question, I mean, for me, though, is I was reading a lot of your work, and I when we talk about where we are as a planet and what people expect on the planet in terms of way of life, even those who don't have it yet, like the way of life we have here or in Western Europe or in some of the wealthier elites of many other countries. And we're not as a species going to go backwards. We're not going to go back into the pre-industrial time and live that way. It's just not going to happen. So,
well, it is going to happen because this way of life isn't sustainable. So by definition, it's going to happen.
So what do you mean by definition it's going to happen?
Because a way of life that isn't sustainable, by definition, can't last. Any way of life that's based on non-renewable resources won't last. If you have 100 donuts, well, donuts is a bad example because you can make more. You've got X amount of oil on the planet. If you're going to run out. And the problem isn't just peak oil. It's also peak water, peak soil, peak rare earths, peak aluminum. I mean, everything, this culture is... I mean, the planet is running out of materials, and this is ignoring the 200 species that went extinct today. If you asked hammerhead sharks if they think this is a very good way of living, I think they would say, I don't think so. And also, if you ask traditional indigenous people if they like this way of living, they say no. That's why they fight for their land. They only want this way of living once they've been dispossessed of their land. And years ago, 1997, I interviewed a member of the Tupac Amaristas, the MRTA. It's a rebel group in Peru. And I said, what do you want for the people of Peru? And he said, we want to be able to grow and distribute our own food. We already know how to do that. We merely need to be allowed to do so. And that's the real struggle, is that I just had a debate in writing with this guy, Kevin Danaher, who was saying that what people in non-industrialized nations want is they want jobs. And I said, no, they actually don't want jobs. What they want is their land back. If they have access to their land, the food, clothing, and if you have access to land, you have access to food, clothing, and shelter. You only need to enter the consumer economy, which means enter the wage economy, once you've been driven off the land. And a great example of this is I have a friend who used to be married to a guy from Bangladesh. And even 15, 20 years ago, his mother would say to him, go catch some fish for lunch. And he would go down to the river, and he would catch fish for lunch. The river will no longer support life because of factories, And so now they have to buy their fish at the store, and the fish come from Iceland. And that's, yes, once you've been brought into this economy, what you want is a job. But I guarantee that if two people went into non-industrialized nations and one of them said, I can get you a job servicing the elite somehow, and the other person said, here's a tangible plan for us to get your land back and for you to have access to the communal life that your ancestors have lived forever, and I'm willing to give you tangible support for whatever you need. In fact, you don't need to give them the plan, because that's just white man's burden again. But instead, so I am here to help you however you need to be helped. And in fact, the best way you can help is by stopping U.S. imperialism. They would go for it. I mean, there are the people in, right now, like I mentioned about the Mekong River, that's not U.S. imperialism, that's Chinese imperialism. But these people are being driven off their land, and they will be forced into the wage economy because of dams to produce electricity for China.
I think you're right. And I think that a lot of what you're saying essentially is correct. But I mean, like, even when you said you did the interview with the Tupac Amaru leader, I mean, you did that in Peru, I take it.
No. He was actually in exile in Germany. And
okay.
We did it by distance, yeah.
So people in this world and have always traveled between place. So the question is, all right, let's say things fall apart the way you're describing, and that because we can't sustain what we have at the moment, or the way we consume. But the technology and the world we've created makes communication and travel pretty instantaneous. That seems to be part of human existence. You're saying that's not sustainable.
I'm saying that you can't have an internet without an electrical grid, and you can't have an electrical grid without fossil fuels.
Right. Or with rare earth minerals. Right. Both.
Rare earth minerals. So once again, obviously I'm on a telephone, and the point here is not to manifest purity. I'm not, you're not saying it is.
No, I'm not.
But the point is, yes, we're using these tools, but if I go back to what the doctor friend of mine said, that doesn't alter the fact that we should recognize they're not sustainable, and we should, I mean, every cell in my body wants for us to be using the technology and fossil fuels and the current infrastructure to make sort of a soft landing. Unfortunately, I just don't see it. You know, you can't even, I mean, it's blasphemy on a global level to even talk about a non-growth economy.
Right.
You know, it's pretty funny that, you know, Al Gore does this whole movie about an inconvenient truth, and if every single person in the United States did every single thing that he suggested in the movie, you know, this happens so often in all these films, they do this great analysis of what's going on, and then their suggestions at the end are always so trivial. They always point away from corporate power. So at the end of the movie, he says we should inflate our tires and change our light bulbs and everything. He doesn't say anything about corporate power. He doesn't say anything about stopping a growth economy. Everybody in the United States did everything he suggested. It would reduce carbon emissions by 21%. But if you still believe in a growth economy, everybody did it. If you still believe in a growth economy, then, you know, if an economy grows 3% a year, that would disappear. That whole reduction would disappear in just a few years. But it's blasphemy to even talk about stopping a growth economy. So how about talking about these on a deeper level? And so my point, once again, is every cell in my body wishes that we were doing this in a really smart fashion. We were relocalizing voluntarily and keeping temporarily the nicer things we want and getting rid of, for crying out loud, who needs retractable stadium roofs, you know? I mean, there's so many things that are just, you know, if I were made, you know, emperor for a day, you know, if I cross all these off the list, and there's a lot of stuff that could be, you know, the Colorado River no longer reaches the ocean.
Right.
And
right.
It's like, okay, people talk about, like, if the dams on the Colorado River fail and the river once again reached the oceans, you know, the corporate press would just bray as one that people are going to die of thirst. So it's like, I wouldn't want to hear one word of complaint so long as there existed golf courses, irrigated alfalfa fields and citrus orchards in Arizona. I mean, it's a desert, so long as Las Vegas existed, you know? They're supposed to be deserts.
Derek, we only have like a few minutes left, and I do want to get one quick call here from a listener.
Sure.
We only have literally like 3 or 4 minutes before we have to roll, but we want to do this for a longer period soon with you. Clarence, you're on the air.
I just have a quick line that I heard, and the line is, we're the only species on the planet stupid enough to destroy its own life support system. Thank you.
Thank you. Derek?
Well, yeah, I would, that brings up a huge thing that people talk about how intelligent, you know, how humans are the only species that's intelligent, which is just crazy on so many levels. I see bears every single day, and they're really smart, you know? I see all sorts of non-humans who are really, really smart. And then he brings up the greatest point of all. I mean, how stupid is it to actually destroy the planet you live on? That's just crazy.
Well, Derek Jensen, I really do look forward to having you back on for a much longer time, both one-on-one and in conversation with others, because I think that we need to really be realistic about where we're going and to start thinking together about what we're going to do and what we're going to confront to get it there.
That's great.
And I appreciate deeply your writing.
Well, thank you. I would love to be on again. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Derek Jensen has been our guest in this part of our program. You can link to all of his writing on our website, steinershow.org, or you can go to the Orion Magazine website as well. His books include Endgame and Truths Among Us, a thinker that makes us think, which is an important thing to have in our society. I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Mortgage Program, a community lending initiative of the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development, at 1-800-638-7781, 1-800-638-7781, and they can aid you in buying a house in the city, even if you're a second-time home buyer. Right now, we're going to take a brief break, and when we come back from this very brief break, we're going to be joined by Christine Nielsen, who is acting in the play currently at Center Stage, where she plays in The Rivals, where she plays Mrs. Malaprop, a very funny play. So stay with us. We'll be right back.